And welcome back, everybody. We're talking with Jay Dyer from jaysanalysis.com. We're going to get into a little bit more here about entertainment. We've been speaking mostly about philosophy, of course, how that's been used against us, but also the tie-in of philosophy and basically the modern world, the reason and the motive to control culture, to have people living in a reality bubble, pretty much. And I was thinking a bit here during the break, Jay, and you know, you talked about manipulation of language. This is one thing that changed drastically, you know, early on or later in human history is, of course, the advent of language, specifically the written language. We have major, you know, pillars of manipulation that comes in, you know, things like religious texts and things like this that drastically change our way of thinking about things. But at the same time, what we're living through today is we don't have, sure, still a literal society, of course, we're faced, but it's visual society. It's like we have a 2.0 version of this now. And I think that Hollywood and the movie industry, which really is a kind of magic, really, is really at the pinnacle and at the essence of this. When did you begin to get interested in the movie aspect of this? And was that just kind of an immediate tie-in to philosophy and you realized the power of movies? Or what was the tie-in there for you?
Yeah, well, I think, as with most of us who grow up in the West and especially in America, I mean, you're going to be, you know, unless you live out in some Amish community, you're going to be affected by or watch movies. So
yeah.
I was always interested in theater. I was kind of a theater, comedy, improv guy in my younger days. I did some stand up for a little while. So I kind of wanted to go that route when I was a younger, naive dude. But as I got older, you know, going into college and getting a better sense of the world, you kind of catch on to what really is the case. And that the entertainment industrial complex is not this, you know, audition where you go and, you know, whoever's got the best talent or whatever gets the job. It's actually a huge machine of control, subversion, psyops, and so forth. And that really came out when, I don't know, I guess probably in my early 20s, you know, around 2001, two, somewhere in there, I started reading a lot of the conspiracy stuff and noticing that, you know, a lot of this is found in movies. You would find these patterns, these, you know, symbols, so forth, so on. And I think you made a great point in one of your talks that is not so much the, you know, hidden eye in the background as it is ultimately the more blatant message of the movies themselves, right?
So yeah, exactly.
You have all kinds of just crazy moral situations and subversive you know, ideas presented in the stories themselves. And so you know, in my view, it's a lot of both, right? So even though we live in an era where we're not surrounded by, you know, religious imagery or icons, as somebody in Byzantium or medieval French village would be surrounded by, you know, Catholic iconography, we've just replaced it with new icons. So just like you were saying with a synthetic version of reality that's been placed before us, Hollywood is kind of our new mythology. It's our new you know, version of the gods and the goddesses, but not in a healthy way.
No, I mean, exactly.
It's in a way that's very destructive. So at the same time, you know, not all the movies are bad. They don't all have subversive messages. You know, so there's still some good stuff, some good art out there that I do think has value. So what I try to do when I do a movie analysis is, you know, I try to be fair to the film, I try to be fair to the story, and focus on good aspects. So sometimes I do point out subversive aspects, but, you know, rather than being constantly obsessed with, you know, the negative and the bad or whatever, you know, let's look at, is there a good philosophical point that can be teased out of this that we can think about? And really that when you get individuals to think in that way, they're not going to be as programmed or as affected by the medium than they would be, you know, otherwise. So, you know, like I said, the idea came from you know, seeing Michael Hoffman's analysis of conspiracy theory a long, long time ago, like back in, you know, when you first starting to use the internet over here in, like, you know, 2003 or so, and some old article that he put up, I came across, and you know, it just seemed like a really good idea. Like, why not do that? And of course, since then, certain other sites have started doing that, but I won't go into that. But Jay's Analysis was the first to start doing that on a regular basis. I guess Michael Hoffman was the first, and the Collins brothers had a great analysis at Conspiracy Archive that dealt with the semiotic basis of the semiotic manipulation in the film Independence Day, and that was kind of an idea that impelled me as well to focus on analyzing propaganda. Why not do that? And it's really started to take off. You know, like I said, it's getting a lot of traction of late.
Now, have you looked deeper into the why as to behind the scenes and the who in terms of why they've chosen to use this method of doing things? You think it's, I mean, it's very clever. Don't get me wrong. It's probably one of the ultimate things that they can do in terms of, you know, shaping, you know, public opinion and keeping people in this reality bubble. And at the same time, parts of me is like, man, you know, it's like it's such a detailed art. You know, I go back and forth on it quite a bit. Sometimes I think these people are just moron. They don't know what the heck they're doing. And then you sit down another day and watch one of those movies again and say, I got to revisit that. And then you look at it and it's like, man, this is brilliant. The manipulation in here is just amazing. You know, and you're like, you go kind of back and forth all the time, but it's an art form nonetheless. That's what they developed. And, so have you looked into more as to the who's and the why behind the scenes?
Oh, absolutely. Especially, you know, doing grad work, you come across, you know, you come across plenty of white papers that deal with the, you know, the Pentagon working with Hollywood, CIA having its liaison in Hollywood. You know, you have to kind of dig, but you do find this stuff, especially if you have, you know, access to like a university library that, you know, where you can look at journals and white papers and scholarly essays that you usually can't get just from Google. And you do find this. You find this that pretty much from the get-go, you know, the establishment realized the power of images. And so the rise of the technocratic process of scientism and so forth, you know, spread to all areas of life. And the realization from war propaganda films and film reels was that, you know, film could be a much better means of pulling the heartstrings of people than, you know, anything like a politician standing up and talking for 30 minutes. You know, that kind of a message is going to be kind of boring compared to, you know, B-52 bombers flying and blowing things up. You know, it's much more exciting, right? So that's going to grab people. So, you know, the tie-in with Bernays and with advertising and propaganda and marketing and all of these kind of coalesce. And I think the establishment, you know, military psyops guys for a long time, Tavistock Institute, you know, Frankfurt School, all these entities and other think tanks have for a long time worked together to perfect the technique. And I think they're still doing it. It's still an ongoing experiment to try different things, try different memes, different symbols, see what the effect is. And that's all recorded. And of course, the rise of the surveillance state ties into that with gauging people's reactions to different things. And so I was on a podcast where James Evan Pilato asked, he said, you know, did you think about how before Interstellar came out, we had a series of space events in the news? You know, there was the SpaceX crash and there was the, you know, landing the probe on the comet or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And then comes Interstellar, right? So you don't hear about NASA, you don't hear about space things in the media for months or years. And then suddenly there's a bunch of space news that's the top story tied in with the great blockbuster that's coming on the scene. And so, yeah, I definitely think that it's not a stretch to say that that a lot of that stuff is by design. A lot of it's marketing, viral marketing, so forth. So yeah, this is all, it's all a big science experiment.
It turned into what was it, the guy who managed to match something, land the thing on the comment. It was turned into Shirtgate, didn't he? It was all about his shirt, right?
Oh, yeah, he wasn't properly feminist.
Exactly, that's right. He had a pin-up on the shirt there or something, and it turned into that as opposed to actually his achievement, of managed to pull this off. But nonetheless, I digress here. But so it becomes about, we could talk more about Interstellar a little bit later. I know you've written about that, and definitely we can get into more, transhumanism, some of the ideas that are pushed there. But I just want to emphasize this point here that it's all about manipulating people emotionally. It's not about, teaching them these morals about, being preachy or I mean, it is didactic, but it's done in such a way that it appeals to your emotion primarily, because here is where the programming is. And I, for the longest time, have thought about and talked with people about the aspect that we have to have the same powerful methods that they use, and we have to do it better, but do it from a good perspective of utilizing the things that they do, powerful music, these wonderful, shots, and do it in such a way. I think that this is a extraordinarily powerful method of doing things, and I would love to see more people getting smart to what really is going on, but beginning to try to stabilize the unstable world we live in right now. What do you think about using movies, but for a positive, or for pushing a different view than the one we get, basically?
Well, I mean, it's, in, military psyops documents, it's literally called InfoWar. So I think that they wouldn't do it if it didn't work. So obviously it works. And, the only way to oppose this system is to do those very things. So I completely agree. I've always been more of a right brain artsy kind of guy, even though I did analytical philosophy. That's always been something I've wanted to do, is to branch out into those kinds of arts. And I've always found film fascinating because it is a mix of several arts. It's the visual, it's the performance, and it's music as well. It has this, it's a unique form that blends a whole bunch of different art forms into one single story, and that there's something unique and like you said, very, very powerful about that. So I definitely think it needs to be hijacked. I mean, it needs to be taken back. It needs to be, there needs to be good versions of these things, which is kind of why, again, like I try to focus on not just the negative aspects, but what's a positive aspect about this film that we can see that gets us thinking critically, like you said, rather than just being pulled along with our heartstrings, on some moralistic, fairy tale that is not realistic or not positive. Rather, thinking in a deeper, critical way. But what you said about its usage, the reason that I focused on Bond is because Bond is a perfect image of the tie-in of what you're talking about. He is the image of the convergence of intelligence agencies, social engineering, and fiction and film.
Yeah.
He starts as, these pulp novels by Ian Fleming, and he becomes a commodity advertising image. The Bond films were the first to have a propaganda placement or product placement. So when James Bond was seen drinking, martinis, suddenly everybody wants to drink martinis, right? And he was there was a Playboy interview with Sean Connery back in the day, and he talked about how, as soon as he was drinking whatever vodka, I forget what it was, Absolut or something, I don't know, but everybody wanted to drink Absolut vodka to be like James Bond. So while Edward Bernays had definitely perfected the idea of social engineering through advertising and marketing with things like smoking, the first time that we really saw it in film was with Bond. And so Bond just kind of exploded into this iconic image that functions on so many different levels. So it's a psyop on one level. It's because the propaganda in the Bond films and novels basically foists upon whoever the Anglo-American establishment doesn't like. It foists upon them what they're doing.
Yeah.
So then that's kind of the great trick of Ian Fleming's works. And if we think about, you know, what's only come about recently from Fleming's story and background, it's only come out recently in certain historical treatments of him, that he was actually a very high level naval psyops officer.
Yeah.
So he's not just a, you know, low level Navy guy who gets ideas for, you know, pulp fiction novels. He was doing high level psyops. So, they were used, very specifically, and they were tremendously successful. It's, I think Harry Potter just overtook Bond for being the most popular film franchise of all time.
Huh. Well, that says quite a bit there, but so what is the reason why they would want to put a character like this out there then? Because it shows about this kind of, you know, the way he's taking care of business and, you know, even talking about, of course, it's the classic world. It's a British intelligence, right? And they're trying to save the world from these evil, wicked, you know, people who pop up all the time. But there's something there which is like, it's curious that they would want to display it in the capacity that they have, everything that goes on.
Well, I think in the novels, Bond's not that, we can actually identify with him because he's actually a middle-class guy from the military who is brought into a secret intelligence service. And he doesn't like the system as we would think. Like I said, he's kind of a Nietzschean Übermensch type of person who's beyond good and evil. He's not this, you know, Western civilization crusader, or he's not the crusader for capitalism per se. He's more of a self-interested guy who doesn't really like the system that he's in, but he sees it as a necessary evil. So to be fair to the way he's presented in the novels, that's kind of who he is. But in the films, he's portrayed more as, you know, more as a goofy kind of jolly philanderer type guy who rescues queen and country from Spectre. But the point being is that I think it demonstrates just how far things have changed from, you know, the time that Fleming was writing to now, because, you know, when I was writing on this, when I was trying to do my thesis, by the way, the thesis isn't finished because I almost got into a fight with my Marxist advisor. This is right. Not the undergrad guy. This is actually the grad school guy who was a hardcore radical Marxist.
Right.
And he actually hated Bond. I mean, he thought it was so, you know, misogynist and so white male who gets women and, you know,
have his way with them. Yeah.
and who stands up for the vestiges of, you know, tradition.
Yeah.
For him, it was awful. I mean, he hated it and he wanted it to be, you know, Bond as a lesbian or something like that. I mean, so we did not get along at all, and we literally almost came to blows. I kind of wish I had punched him in the face now, but
yep, know what you're talking about.
But even though Bond represents a lot of things that we would disagree with, I mean, there have even been discussions of making, you know, Bond into a black guy or a woman, right? I mean,
right, of course.
Not that I have a problem with a black guy doing something like that, but the point is that the subversion has gotten so intense and things have changed so much even in the last 20 years that for Bond to even be, you know, a white male is somehow bad. Well, that's
right.
The tradition of what he, it's a literary tradition of a guy who's that guy, you know?
Yeah.
It's like Russell talking about, Bertrand Russell talking about getting rid of Shakespeare because he didn't want in the technocracy, you know, anyone to know the English language. It's just insane.
Hmm. Wow. Yeah, it has changed so drastically and radically. And they've, again, I think they've managed to pull off this change primarily with entertainment media, yes, pop culture, right. Music, television shows, right? That's the way they've done it.
Yeah, I mean, everybody's, well, I mean, just look at hip hop. I mean, when I was in like seventh or eighth grade, you know, nobody listened to hip hop. It wasn't, I mean, it was kind of just then getting on MTV and kind of getting popular.
Yeah.
And now that's all the music industry is pretty much hip hop and fake country. You know, I don't live too far from the center nexus of all fake pop country.
Nashville.
Exactly. Yeah. It's the, And that also is it's I know people who work in that industry and who have been a part of the music scene there, and it's very, very, very fake. I know that sounds kind of like a teenager critiquing things, but it's so
Right.
fake, man. But no, seriously, it really is another version of what, well, it's what the critical theorists called the culture industry. It's an industry of creating and manipulating culture.
Yeah. We can definitely talk a little bit more about some of your other, focused movies that you've done, the gone through rather. And let's talk, you brought up Interstellar a little bit earlier. Let's just kind of talk a little bit more about that. And what your take on that was. I did go see it recently, but let's take the position that, yeah, okay, they did, for whatever reason, either if they capitalized on coincidence that, these stories came out in the press beforehand. And by the way, I did see a tremendous amount of write-ups about the movie too. I gotta say that too. It was like even before the movie comes out, even on these like random scientific magazines, Science Daily or whatever, they're like writing, is it possible to do what they do in Interstellar and stuff like that? So all of that can, of course, be marketing. It can also be just that the buzz is there, so they're jumping on the opportunity to get an extra hit or two. So I don't know that, but what would be the reason, let's say, why they would want to push Interstellar the way they did?
Well, you mentioned a minute ago, why would Bond be used in this or that way? My view is that the social engineers and psych warfare experts, et cetera, they understand archetypes. So they understand, in the Jungian idea, Carl Jung of, and this ties in a little bit with Platonism too, the idea of there being forms or preeminent images of things that we all identify with and relate to. So, for example, the mother archetype. We all grew up with, most of us, with a mother or with a father, and the sage archetype, so forth. But from the perspective of manipulation or engineering, what you can do is take these archetypal images and manipulate or turn them in a certain way. And I think that a lot of psychological warfare deals with that. Well, actually, I know it does. And so, it's basically, you said, playing on people's heart, pulling on heartstrings and leading them in a certain way. It also deals with, playing on our fears. And so the manipulation of what our greatest fears are is one of the main functions of, say, the news, right? So mass film productions, these big blockbusters, kind of give us our new hope, whereas mass media and news tries to give us our constant fear,
Yeah,
right? There's
yeah.
a fear-hope dialectic there between those, that forked tongue of the snake of mass culture there. But with Interstellar, I think what we had, I don't really, I'm not sure what I think about Christopher Nolan as a director. I mean, he seems to present good messages in his films, but I don't overall, but I don't know what his personal views are. And I've listened to interviews. I know that he does talk about archetypes and Jungian thought and things like that. But as that goes, I don't know. So I just kind of look at the films. I think with The Prestige, we had a lot of what I call, what Hoffman calls, twilight language or synchronistic kind of connections that are made on a deeper level in a film that is about what you think is a magician, right? So it's magicians on a stage show, but it turns out to be kind of a deeper level message of how film as a medium works, period. It's all kind of stage magic, right? And I think he's got a similar idea with Interstellar, but this is his version of Kubrick's 2001 Space Odyssey. So there's
Yeah.
a lot of plays on 2001.
That's what I thought when I saw it too. It was really like it was really playing on that and kind of managed to pull some of it off too, I thought,
Yeah, I liked it, but I kind of like science fiction to begin with, so maybe I'm biased. I'm gonna like a science fiction story more than most people, even if it's not that great. But there was just so many tie-ins, so many things that it dealt with. Maybe it tried to overreach, maybe it dealt with too much, I don't know. But he tried to throw in a lot of really interesting philosophical and scientific concepts, in a film and in a dumbed down movie industry that's so cookie cutter and synthetic. You know, we don't really see at least that kind of, interesting depth that's being dealt with. But
and sorry to interrupt, but that could be one of those cases too, right? Where I've encountered that many times with many directors. They say they have to fight to be able to make that one movie that they want to make. And then in return, they have to like, okay, you have to do the three Batman movies and whatever it was, right? To get the opportunity to even make something like Inception. That's what I thought. So they kind of slip through the cracks sometimes, some of those movies, right?
Yeah, I think there's a mix. I think there are genuine artistic types. And most of my friends tend to be, artsy, creative types. And I know that, they don't like the system and the establishment, and they have to constantly, kind of fight to do what they want to do. One of my good friends draws Game of Thrones, and he's talked about the pressures that the different corporations put on him, to do things a certain way. So he can't really, you're just tied down, I guess, as an artist, because you're working, you're kind of a commodity as well, But with this, I think with Interstellar, what we have is just basically a turn from 2001, where instead of the astronaut Bowman going into the abyss or crossing the abyss and then emerging as Starchild after a battle with the artificial intelligence, Nolan tried to give the idea that what if artificial intelligence could actually be the means by which it's achieving the next level of apotheosis or evolution or whatever is achieved. So I think that transhumanism or super advanced technology could be, obviously it could be a great thing, it could do all kinds of wondrous things, but with the establishment that we have who is running all that, that's not what they want. So I think they want to sell people the idea that, all this great technology is going to be for you and it's going to be the utopia. Rather, it's going to be probably more like something in Elysium, where everybody's kind of left to just be, in a hellhole on Earth, on Terra Firma, right? And then the blessings and the utopia are for the special class.
Right, yeah. The elite. And so let's look at some of the things that you went through in Interstellar, and how do you think that they pushed also transhumanism there? Is it more to kind of try to because I thought it was quite interesting that they, of course you end up in the time travel conundrum as you always do, and getting your message beforehand, and or getting aid by the fact that you managed to get somewhere, but you would never get there if you didn't do this kind of thing, and some catch 22 kind of thing. But what did you see as the main kind of, I guess, thing that was pushed in Interstellar? Was it this achievement by transcending with the aid of technology, basically?
Well, I think there were a lot of things being said, one of which was, first of all, that the NASA wasn't shut down, and there was that stupid Obama story from 2 or 3 years ago about how NASA didn't have any money anymore, and that's completely baloney. I mean, there's, the black budget for that kind of stuff is, tens of billions a year. So NASA, in my view, is just kind of a front for a real space and weapons program. And most of it comes out of weaponizing of space. It's not really about exploration. So I did like the message that Nolan had about, why don't we get back to the idea of actually exploring. I'm all for going to other planets and exploring. I think the I think that God made the universe for us to expand out and grow and explore it. In my view. So I like that message of it. I also like that he didn't present he presented technology as something that has the potential to aid us. So it's more so how we use it. I mean, there's nothing inherently wrong with a thing. It's like you were saying with film, it's how it's used. So, are we going to let these elites, rob us of these advancements based on hidden metaphysics and so forth? Or are we going to be smart about this and not destroy ourselves? Because, I mean, the potential is there for, wiping out the globe. So,
yeah, they kind of show that in the beginning too, right? With the blight or whatever they call it, the earth is kind of, right. Dying. Everyone is stuck growing GMO corn or whatever they were doing there, right?
Yeah, and although it wasn't specifically mentioned, you kind of get the impression that he's hinting that genetically modified or, geoengineering or something like that is what's wrecked things. And that's actually what we see with atmospheric manipulation and genetically modified salmon getting out into the population. I mean, that's, and the seeds, the Terminator seeds and so forth. So that's probably, I'm just speculating, what he might've had in mind that actually we are the ones that are screwing all this up. And we may have to flee this planet because of what we've done.
Yeah. It's pretty interesting. It's all, a lot of those kinds of components there. And then another part of me also feels that's another, kind of push that they're seeking to do that. Yeah. The earth is dying. We have to leave. And part of me is like, no, we have to take care of our home. We have to make sure we don't end up in that situation. But it's a lot of that, that push that it's like, too many people, too much resources are being spent. And I definitely see that. I mean, I've actually changed my mind in regards to, a lot of people are very, anti the elite for the purposes that they push, this, what they call an overpopulation myth. But I don't know, the more people we get on this planet, I'm starting to get some of those ideas that we can't just expand indefinitely. If we are to expand, then at least we have to, as you said, we have to actually travel to other planets and continue and expand our realm of where we achieve to get resources, right?
Yeah, I think you're right. That's a really, really complex issue. It's very hard to have an easy answer on that. But unfortunately, the those that are in control don't have, generally speaking, humanity at they don't have humanity's interest at hand.
No.
I think the danger is that when you have a completely self-interested elite, Nietzsche talked about I think it's Beyond Good and Evil. He talks about the elite. It's either Ecce Homo or Beyond Good and Evil. He talked about the reason that the elite self-destruct is because they eventually get so detached from the real world from how things work that they just kind of degenerate and implode. And I think that there's all the more potential for that when you have an elite that's going to have, advanced technology that can do basically everything and anything. You know what I mean? I mean, if you don't have to learn basic math anymore, right? I mean, you can just talk to Siri or something and she talks back to you and tells you that 2 + 2 = 5, right? I mean, according to Common Core.
Yeah, exactly.
then, you're going to be left with a weak, degenerate, self-destructive elite. So I don't know. Those are really, really tough questions. I've read a good bit on population and race and those kinds of issues. So I don't have an easy answer to that, but yeah, you're right to point that out in the film that the resource war, which is something that the elites have used for a long time as a means of control, is definitely present in the film. And what the solutions are there, I'm not sure, because we can sit and talk about the solutions and maybe even have a really, really great idea for a solution, but the problem is that other human beings tend to not really care or be concerned with good solutions.
No, that's true. And we don't have, we don't have those people, it feels like, on in those positions where we can make the changes as well that is taking place. I mean, right. Let's face it, we're in the hands of these people, and they seem to, be able to vet anyone who actually has some kind of good ideas to contribute. And we're like, we're very much in that slave position. We can sit around and complain on them all day, and I guess we should criticize them. But at the end of the day, if they're the ones pulling the strings and we're doing nothing, we have to get out of that situation, actually attain a position of actually, having some kind of power to be able to detopple the elite, right?
Absolutely. I get asked all the time, what's the answer? What's the answer? And I always say, well, there are people say, what's your view on this? What do you think about this? on a lot of these kind of grand scale issues, you know, I could say, well, on the one hand, there's what I would like to be the case. And then on the other hand, there's the, you know, pragmatic situation of what I actually have to do in this. So,
yeah,
you know, I kind of live in an anarchic way. I would like to be as off of the system as possible and as, you know, out in the country and so forth. That's the way that I personally existentially operate in this video drome that we live in, this matrix or whatever.
Yeah.
But, you know, I tend to have somewhat of a negative view of how successful, you know, really changing this system will be, even though I think that, you know, we still have to. I mean, what are you going to do? Just, you're going to go get vaccines and start eating GMO? No, I mean, you have to fight it and you have to go against it. But whether it's actually going to be changed, I don't know.
I think lately, anyway, I see it's even more beyond that. It's not just about taking care of, you know, me and myself and my people in my surrounding and trying to, you know, bring them aboard to these issues that are harmful to them and enlighten them about that. But I think it's our responsibility to actively try to change what's happening in every way that we possibly can, right? And for me, anyway, it's boiled down to these things that, right, it is a numbers game. We need to try to influence as many people as possible. That is an easier way of doing it than if you're just, you know, alone screaming from the rooftops. You know, it's so, you know, what is the core issue of what we need to change? And again, I actually go back to that idea that they've used culture against us, they've used entertainment against us and pop culture and all these things. And to a certain extent, that's where we have to be. And I mean, look at even how, you know, we can see the distribution thing is changing with digital formats. You know, you can even buy a pretty nice looking camera for cheaps these days. And there's actually a lot of things that you can do,
right,
even if you don't have a massive budget. And I think more people need to get aboard on that. And they need to realize that by the time people fall off of these, you know, regular entertainment stuff and go seeking something else, these people need to be in place and already have something to offer there. So I think the time is now to get in on that and really expand there, you know?
I think that's a great idea. You're totally on point there. That's exactly what I'd like to do as well. I mean, I'd like to see more of that. I want to do more of that. I want to expand, you know, do more interviews, more film analysis, start doing videos and so forth. At least that's the plan. But I'd like to, there's some really interesting esoteric stuff that came out in these films, both, whether it's Terminator or Interstellar or Artificial Intelligence. I'd like to get into some of that esoteric stuff because that really ties into the archetype manipulation, the way that social engineers, controllers, and so forth are able to craft these stories with a certain message that's going to speak not just to our conscious mind, but to our subconscious. And that's really how it's done, because the conscious mind has the tendency to, well, for some people at least, to be more logical, more critically attuned. But the subconscious mind doesn't work that way. It's like you said, it's more feeling based in that it receives these impressions and kind of interacts with them from, in my view, kind of the perspective of the heart, more so than the logical, you know, analytical actions of the brain. And what we have in Interstellar, for example, is Nolan, again, borrowing from not just 2001, but older mythological stories, classical mythology that are part of the Western tradition that I think kind of come down to us as part of our subconscious. In other words, the stories that we see with the Iliad, the Odyssey, with Virgil and the Aeneid, with Dante, so forth, these all kind of have similar patterns and themes that I think speak to the common experience of at least Western man. And so, for example, we see something like the katabasis in the Greek literary tradition, which is the descent that the hero takes. So in 2001, Bowman goes on this journey away from home, and he enters into, you know, the abyss, and then he comes out back to Earth as Starchild. This is that classic motif of the Katabasis, and we see it with Cooper in Interstellar, where he goes on this journey, again, like 2001, enters the abyss, comes back in a form of resurrection. In Christianity, we have the story of Christ's descent into hell and then resurrection. You see this consistently. Orpheus, the Orphic mysteries, Orpheus goes to the underworld and comes back. And what I've started noticing lately is that classic pattern of Western literary theory is present in a lot of films.
A lot of them, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, I know that's a well-known old pattern, but again, what you see is that, and I don't want to say all the films are formulaic, because you know that would mean that, well, Virgil was just being formulaic when he wrote the Aeneid. I mean, the Aeneid's a great work, and in a way that, I mean, you have to stand on the shoulders of your forebearers of your tradition. So it's, in a degree, it's unavoidable. But I noticed reviewing AI, Spielberg and Kubrick's artificial intelligence, that there was the same kind of idea that David, the progenitor of a new race of artificial beings, he undergoes the Katabasis, where he goes on this journey away from home. He's separated from his mother archetype and undergoes a watery abyss or death, reminiscent of the frozen sections of Dante's Inferno, and then is later resurrected to a new daytime eternal existence.
Right. Yeah.
So I think that motif is there, and what a lot of the transhumanist stuff is doing is selling us a message or a narrative of another way to be resurrected, right? So nobody wants to die, right? That's a death is one of the probably the ultimate fear that we have as mortals, and so the purveyors of transhumanism, the marketers, I think, have found a new grand narrative for the West. So to replace the older mythologies and religious texts and narratives with a new one that involves probably ultimately, this maybe sound a little far-fetched here, but I think they probably will blend some kind of alien story with transhumanism, and we're going to get some kind of mixed message of, channeled interdimensional otherworldly beings that have given us the advanced transhumanist technology, the post-human era, that'll take us to the next. I mean, that's just my speculation. And you see that with the UN and the New Age movements tied into, alien stuff. I think aliens are ridiculous, but that's kind of what comes out in a lot of these films. You know, the AI in AI have a very alien appearance, and of course Spielberg, so that's classic alien propaganda and mythology. But I saw parallels with E.T. too, because you have two letters, E and T, being the title of the film, and then this film being A and I. So there's probably a deeper connection with esoteric or Kabbalistic usage of numerals and letters.
Yeah.
And it's also fascinating that because Kubrick was involved in this writing the story for AI, that AI came out in 2001. So it appeared in theaters in 2001. And of course, Kubrick's most famous film is 2001, A Space Odyssey. So just like Nolan with Interstellar, it's as if Spielberg wanted to do his kind of version of 2001, right? So David, like Bowman in 2001, or Cooper in Interstellar, different versions of this same Katabasis trek or journey or adventure, different takes on these classic literary motifs.
Interesting. And it seems to me as well that it's going to be pushed, for our survival purposes, basically, that if we don't, accept this or accept to go into the transhuman age, the post-human age, we are not going to survive or whatever. And who knows, maybe it's the scorched earth strategy here, that basically even they will take everyone down you know, screaming if they have to. But it certainly seems that we're dealing with an elite that has no recognition for the fact that they live on the same planet as well. And what concerns, you know, us should also concern them. And it doesn't seem to be the case, you know?
Oh, well, think about what's one of the most popular genres that we've just been inundated with in terms of film and novel and comic book, you name it. It's apocalypticism. I mean, that's all we've been given the last 10, 15 years is just constant apocalyptic stories. And that absolutely ties into the controlled resource war that you're mentioning, that is manipulated. It's completely gamed. You know, economics, all of it is completely gamed by the system to create the impression of there not being enough, you know, resources. And again, like you said, that can be debated for, you know, certain areas, India, China, there are obvious overpopulation issues there. Yeah.
And look at the projections too, by the way, of what, you know, just adding on billions in the next 40 years, is it going to last? But okay, we can leave that for now.
But from the perspective of just fear, basic fear, like, you know, there's not going to be enough food I can walk outside my house and, you know, there are bushes there's fruit that's edible, right?
Yeah.
There's water out. So the idea that we have to be dependent on these resources, petroleum products, you know, that was all engineered by the Rockefellers, oil, so forth. You know, that there's not going to be enough food. There's not going to be enough. I mean, on one level, that's a lot of just fear to move people into greater levels of control. So yeah, definitely. At least for us here. Right. But I mean, in China, you know, India, places like that, you're right. But really, I mean, it's Western man. That's the main target of depopulation. I mean, it's Western society that's
exactly
dropping into, right.
Exactly. And I mean, that's occurring already as well. We have an infertility problem, and you know, all of these issues are occurring. And of course, at the same time, that's kind of the moral, aspect of this too, right? Do your part, don't leave, you know, your carbon footprint too heavy on the planet. Exactly. You know, have less kids, etc. And that seems to only really be aimed at Western man right now.
Right, China doesn't have all those rules, and in fact, you know, the whole climate scam, we know is a scam from the Club of Rome. I mean, I know this is kind of classic alternative media conspiracy stuff, but it bears repeating that, you know, in the Club of Rome documents, they discuss the fact that, you know, humanity is the problem. And in one sense, humanity is the problem because humans are the ones that are, you know, screwing everything up.
Right. Yeah.
But it's almost, it's like, it reminds me of like bad girlfriends I've had where I'm dating a gal and she does a whole bunch of crazy stuff and it messes everything up and you call her out on it and she says, well, I did crazy stuff because of you.
Right. Yeah.
It's like, well, but you did the crazy stuff first. Well, yeah, but I did the crazy stuff because of you. Right. So it's gaslighting, or like that you see in a relationship with a crazy girlfriend or something. It's,
right. Yeah.
We're all supposed to feel guilt. It's a lot of fear, a lot of guilt manipulation. You know, you're bad because you drive a car and because you, you know, it's just completely ridiculous though.
They give us these ways of life and then they blame us for that we're adopting those ways of life, basically.
Exactly. Right. I mean, speaking of that, I mean, how many times has that come up in films, by the way? You know, you see, you know, in the 80s, I can think of examples of where it was global warming was constantly the message of movies. And I remember reading, when I was doing my grad work, I remember reading, I dug up these old articles that Paul Ehrlich had written about global warming. Mm-hmm. And they were from like 1982, 83, 84. And in every one of these, you know, scholarly white paper journal essays and articles, he's talking about how there's no way we're going to survive to 1988. You know, we're never going to make it to 19. There's just no way. So when you watch the engineered apocalypticism, right, catastrophism as a technique of control, I mean, it's just a constant. It's just like Hal Lindsey or any of these goofy TV preachers or Benny Hinn. you know, John Hagee talking about the, you know, the rapture coming next year and the tribulation. It's the same methods. It's all the same techniques.
And they're playing on those same archetypal fears that we have inside of us of this. But okay, so let's say we're talking to a person who's like, well, you know, whatever, I'm not, yes, I go see movies, you know, who knows, every other week or something on the weekends, or, but I'm not manipulated by that stuff, right? But how does this affect us? I mean, think about it. These are things that we see, and today with the special effects being they are the way they are, the audio being the way it is, just magnificent productions. These are things that, whether you want it or not, is going to be added onto your reference frame of life experiences when you watch these movies, correct?
Absolutely. Unfortunately, that is true. And this is a highly, highly specialized scientific technique as well. The process of achieving different effects through flicker rates, through film, so forth. In fact, I saw an article not too long ago about how they had even perfected the way that a crash scene needs to occur so that it has the most traumatic psychological effect in the viewer.
Yeah,
right.
So absolutely.
They'd done this through, you know, continual studies of audiences watching films and gauging the reactions of their retina and their, you know, heartbeat. I mean, it's just crazy.
Yeah.
Like who would come up with, you know, thinking to do this? It's just insane. So there's that's just stuff we know about. Who knows what's going on with, you know, it's way beyond subliminal messages or backmasking, or I mean, there's just no telling what's going on with you know, what might be, say, layered underneath what you're seeing in a certain image that sticks in your subconscious, right?
Yeah,
your subconscious, right?
Yeah.
Sounds that you might hear, frequencies that are broadcast during certain scenes. I mean, there's just no end to it.
I've actually discovered that many times when I go see a movie, I can feel that my body is actually reacting in a certain way. There's like a biological trigger that has occurred, you know, through my sensory input. And then I have to like try to stop that or like gauge myself from, okay, why are you know, kind of analyzing as you go and try to think about that. I think that's one way of trying to deal with that, of putting it in that compartment. Because I mean, I enjoy watching movies, not that. Most of it is crap these days. There's a lot of garbage messages in there, of course. There's absolutely, you know, subversive filth, you know, and I know that. And you know, part of it is why I watch it, is because I want to know what that is so that I can analyze it and bring it into the work we're doing here, you know. But at the same time, I feel I need to put that in a compartment which is separate, you know, and almost I need to have an active awareness of, okay, you know, put this in that compartment and don't let it get to you in any kind of way, because it's, you know, as you say, it's quite freaky these days considering what they're doing, you know.
Yeah, no, I think a lot of it is how you perceive it. It's how you approach the film, you know, how you go into the theater, what you're thinking, what you're expecting. And so as long as we aren't turning off our critical thinking and our, you know, analytical side, I don't think we have to be too afraid. But then again, yeah, maybe I'm like completely brainwashed. Maybe I've watched too many movies.
Yeah.
I don't know.
No, I don't think so. I think that over paranoid conspiracy theorists,
right,
that everything is like, oh my God, the perimeters of these circles, you know, completely mind control you when you, you know, whatever, right? You get some of that in the conspiracy field.
Every
quite a
eyeball,
bit, actually.
Every eyeball is an Illuminati message.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there you go. Overkill, you know. So yeah, so it's a balanced approach to these things, as always, as usual. And then at the same time, as you said, there are good things coming through. There are these wonderful, you know, I complain quite a bit about, you know, our stories are no longer in these movies. They're not represented. We're not, you know, getting the classic, you know, pieces of stories that we could get. And then at the same time, in a certain way, we kind of are, as you've pointed out, that these classic thematical archetypal stories, they are there. And in some cases, of course, they're used in such a way so that they will appeal to you, whether that's on a, right, you know, genetic memory level or whatever occurs there, but they appeal to you. And then, of course, they try to subvert you with using those. So that's what we have to watch out of.
Well,
the latter.
I think exactly. I think one piece of good news is that I'm seeing more films that are at least dealing with philosophical topics. A lot of independent films are doing that, and that's a good sign. At the same time, it's also good news. Hollywood is not doing well box office wise. Really, they're only coasting on the fumes of comic book movies. So I think that, you know, even Spielberg said a year or two ago that, you know, Hollywood and movies are pretty much dead. So I think what's going to happen is large box office theaters are gradually going to not totally go away, but, you know, more and more people are just going to be sitting in their houses glued to Netflix and glued to the internet. So yeah, things are going that way. And what I think that will do is possibly open up the avenue for organic, independent film theaters, you know, people showing stuff that they've done. You know, I think that trend will come back. You see what I'm saying?
Like, yeah, definitely.
People will want that, you know, classic aesthetic experience of going to a film and seeing it. And because Hollywood won't be concerned with that, they're going to be focusing on getting everybody just staring at, you know, whatever the latest Netflix show is. It'll give a lot more freedom for independent film and independent thinking.
Yeah, it is. I don't necessarily like the word, but it's being democratized for, you know, to a certain extent, and it's being, you know, spread out. And again, as I said before, you know, the availability of doing things now yourself, and, you know, so I always urge when we talk about these things, but like, we people are into these kinds of topics and subjects, and, you know, analyzing and watching these stuff. We need to develop like our own streaming channel, a network of sorts or something. You know, there needs to be something in the wings here and operating and functioning. And I wish that there are people who have money, they have some resources, they know how to do some stuff or whatever, what have you, that have an interest in these things and realize that, because I mean, these kinds of topics, this is the battlefield. This is like, ultimately it's survival that we're talking about here, and the dedication have to be that of us as well. You know, in the West, we have to realize that we're under attack. We have to, you know, grow up and realize we have to take control of this ourselves, or no one is going to do it for us, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I've got two notebooks full of sketch comedy, but I don't have any benefactors or connections to, you know, to act. That doesn't mean that they're good. Maybe they're not, maybe they're dumb and not fun. I don't know. I think I can be funny on occasion, but no, I mean, I think I'm totally on board with that. I think we need to start doing our own forms of art, start doing this kind of stuff. And I totally agree. I don't believe in democracy in a radically egalitarian kind of way. That's completely fake. You know, that's oligarchical control is all that is.
Yeah. Yeah.
But from the perspective of pragmatically doing what's necessary, in independently doing things. And I think that if it's good, it's going to catch on. People are going to, you know, as junk is everywhere, people are eventually going to want, they're going to have a thirst for aesthetically pleasing things, for positive things. I mean, there's going to be a tremendous vacuum there.
Well, absolutely. Exactly. I mean, in the age of synthetic, which is basically everything we're getting now, and as you say, sameness, just pathological egalitarianism, just mediocrity across the board, things that are sticking out, things that are, you know, raw and just beautiful and authentic in their own, that's something I feel that more and more people are going to begin to fall back to, as, you know, the pro-establishment, you know, revolutionaries that we have out there are pushing further and further into, you know, the mainstream, and everything that they were representative about, you know, 40 years ago has now become established in the world, and we don't have a true rebellion of sorts anymore. But it's from this area it will come. It's kind of a fallback to authenticity. That's where I see it, this is going to bloom out of. You know.
Yeah, I mean, Nietzsche said that you know, the arts could be what could save things. You know, I don't agree with everything Nietzsche said, but you know, there's probably something to that, that aesthetics would be the way that man would rise out of this morass and this mediocrity. And you know, recent examples, I was surprised at Snowpiercer. Snowpiercer was, you know, a foreign semi-independent film that had a good message. It had a message about dialectics, about revolutions being used. It discussed geoengineering, chemtrails, you know, really profound indie, relatively independent film that had a good message. So it's not it can be done. And that film was very, very successful for having, you know, the small marketing that it did. You know, it didn't have a major release in the US, but it was, you know, very successful. So it's not impossible to do. It can be done. I'm seeing, you know, just this year, there were two kind of indie movies that were made that dealt with, one was a version of Dostoevsky's The Double. There was another film with Jake Gyllenhaal, The Enemy, that was a similar idea of doppelganger. But it had a lot of good messages. It had him talking about, as a professor, you know, statism and the dangers of statism. And, you know, I'm seeing, you know, maybe I'm just overly hopeful, but I'm seeing, you know, little flickers of hope and light here in the artistic community.
Yeah.
You know, that I don't think are all revelation of the method. I mean, not everything is not revelation of, you know, dark wizards ruining everything. You know, there are people that you know, really do want to live life well and flourish and put out good art.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, very good stuff. I mean, we've really just kind of scraped some of the surface here today. You have so much good stuff on the website, and I do urge people to go there and check it out, jasonanalysis.com. Tons of reviews, but a lot of other stuff too, more on the, you know, philosophy and, you know, just the elite and a lot of things that we did talk about. So I do urge people to go over there and check it out. And yeah, it would be great to have you back again, Jay, and actually kind of just continue and talk more about some of the things we didn't get to today. Time went by way too quick, but I want to thank you so much for coming on. And please let us know if there's something you'd like to leave us with, either something you have, you know, upcoming, or how people can, you know, get involved or get a hold of you on the website or something like that.
Yeah. Like I said, you can go to Jay's Analysis and you'll see, what I'm trying to do right now is, I've been posting lectures on, Plato. So I've been just kind of going through, and rather than having, you know, the androgynous, Marxist lesbian, ponytail professor barking the meaning of Plato at you, what I try to do is give a more traditional reading, give a more, you know, a more classical interpretation of Plato at this point. And I'd like to branch out and keep doing philosophy lectures. And what I kind of do is, it's kind of based on your setup. I say, you know, if you subscribe for, you know, $4.95 a month, what I'll do is, you know, continue to put these lectures out and I'll give them to you first, right? So it'll go up on the website 2, 3, 4, 5, you know, a week later. But you'll go ahead and get a lecture, and I'd like to, you know, work all the way through Plato, so you could have the complete body of Plato's works, you know, over a few months, you know, just because most people don't have time, you know, to read 1,500 pages, but you can hear,
right, yep,
you know, a good overview of the majority of those classics that I think need to be brought back. And nobody reads Plato anymore. Nobody reads these, you know, these great classics. We all in the West, at least, we have these, you know, Marxist leftist indoctrination versions of all these things.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's a really good, you know, service, you know, to be able to get that without that, through that Marxist lens. And I think that's super important. I mean, you should be a, you know, philosophy professor for an alternative community for advanced homeschooling courses or something.
No,
like that.
No, that's what I would. I wanted to be a professor. That's what I went for. And then once you know, you don't realize when you're 19, when you go into that system, that it's completely dominated, especially in America, by, you know, pretty dedicated, you know, pretty serious Marxists.
Same in Europe. Yeah, definitely. They're worldwide. Well, there's in the West. That's the point. You know, that's where they are. That's where they've gotten their stranglehold. So yeah, definitely. Well, keep up the good work, Jay. And yeah, as I said, thank you so much for coming on, and we'd love to have you back again.
Absolutely. I'd love to. And it was a great talk. Thank you, Henrik.
We are going to be back with Patrick Henningsen next, a show on the absurdity of how the media has dealt with the Ferguson debacle, and the follow-up with the Eric Garner campaign as a way to retry what the PC media initially failed to start. Later, we have the Swedish surveyor, Laird Scranton, Marion van Court, Conrad from Radio Landsman, and others as we move into 2015. I hope you have a great New Year celebration, and restate your goals, reassess your situation, think about all the things that we've learned, and of course, build on new ground from here as we move forward and expose the lies of the political class and what they have in store for us. It's time we move out of the comfort zone and realize that this is for real, and start fighting back for real on every level. Of course. course, doing this in a smart way and in the right way. Well, thank you for a great year, my friends and dear listeners. Thank you for being a member as well. We couldn't do this without you. And we're getting ready to step up our game here into the new year as well. We'll be back with more here in just a few days again. So hang on tight, stay cool, and we'll talk to you soon.